Blog Talk Radio. very far over many lands and seas. He was very shy, and there was so much sadness in his eyes, but very wise, so wise was he. The greatest thing you'll ever learn is to love and be loved in return.
Marvin didn't try to be magic or charismatic and all that. He just was. Even when he sung the national anthem, I mean, it was Marvin Gaye. You know, it was just unique. It was special.
Can you see?
You're about to see and hear, should you be so foolish as to have just joined, this is Ray Charles.
Hello. All right. 3, 4.
I got something, yo, in my bones. Make me
make me want to shout hallelujah. And I want to
sing along.
Lift every voice and sing, till it in heaven ring, ring with the harmony, oh, liberty. Let our rejoice and rise high, burning the time, loud as the Lord's sea.
Partners in Community Building focuses on credit building, financial literacy, and home ownership for residents throughout Chicago and Illinois. All of our services are free. Call 312-328-0873 to get additional information on our home ownership counseling, rental assistance, Cook County foreclosure mediation, and small accessible repairs for seniors programs. PCIB is a HUD-certified nonprofit counseling agency committed to addressing the housing needs of all people. Call 312-328-0873 to schedule an appointment or visit us at www.pcibchicago.org.
For true inspiration, check out singer, songwriter, and radio personality Sylvia Fedrick. Sylvia, your sister under God's construction, brings to you her best in Christian contemporary gospel tunes, and they are available for download at www.sangsyl.com. That's SANGSYL.com. Or you can visit her profile at Chicago Black Business Network. For bookings, call Sassy Michelle at 512-914-4221.
Want to learn the secrets of the wealthy? Do you think that the wealthy sell their gold and silver, or do they buy gold and silver? Learn to create wealth, collect wealth, and preserve wealth for you and future generations. Find out how you can acquire free silver every month. Visit goldandsilverplan.com. That's goldandsilverplan.com. What you don't know can keep you struggling financially. What you know can change your life. Be in the know. Visit goldandsilverplan.com today.
Hey, you want more money in your pocket, right? Savers are losers, unless you save like the rich and beat inflation. The secret? Save the right kind of money. Pure, solid, 24-karat gold or silver for as little as $20 a week, direct from the mint. Don't spend money. Exchange bad money for good money. Start today at SaveMetalMoney.com. That's SaveMetalMoney.com. The chains of slavery in the modern world are not forged with links of iron, but with the bonds of limiting ideas and debt.
Be in business for yourself, but not by yourself. Team up with a company voted the 57th most promising by Forbes, with no money to collect from your customers, no credit checks, and no cost for you to join. Visit electricmoneyteam.com, 773-980-9288. That's electricmoneyteam.com, 773-980-9288.
Hi there, I'm the X-Man, Xavier Paul. I'm a national network voiceover talent. You've heard my voice represent hundreds of brands and businesses for the past 15 years. Well, now it's your turn. I understand how important it is to promote your business or event in the right way. That starts with quality radio spot production and the nation's top voiceover talent. You might wonder, how do I get started? What's the best approach? What voice talent do I use? And most importantly, can I do it affordably? That's why I created CoolVoiceRadio.com. I take you to the finish line, giving you everything you need to advertise effectively on the radio. I'll help you create your concept, write your spot, even choose your music and cast your voice talent and get it aired on the radio. Now that's cool. Email me today at info@coolvoiceradio.com or call 646-326-7800 because nothing beats the right sound.
Thank you. Radio Network is now on the air, everybody. What it do, how you do, and how, what's going on, everybody, how you feel today. Sorry about the 30-minute delay of the show yesterday, but the 8:30 to 10:30 show. But there's a special event going on at the Harold Washington Cultural Center, a tribute to Chicago's greatest mayor, Harold Washington. And we had a lot of great guests. I couldn't get them on, but it was excellent. We did a nice little tribute to our man Blues, Artie Blues, Boy Whitehall, so that was kind of cool. But what I would like to discuss is, are we letting our rights go as American citizens now that we have all these now European Muslims or European terrorists or homegrown terrorists or militia? We have these individuals now coming into our neighborhoods causing terror and mayhem, you know. Manslaughter is killing four or more people at once, so manslaughter. So let's look at that for a second. You know, are we okay with cameras monitoring us because cameras help catch the Boston bombers? Do we want more cameras following us, or do we still want our privacy? We're going to deal with that. I wanted to get into that yesterday because someone sent me an excellent presentation that Bill Moyers did this weekend on Bill Moyers Live. It airs on PBS. I was going to play that. We're also going to probably deal with that morning after pill. Is abortion still on the top subject for people's minds now that there's a morning after pill? And we're going to get the response to Chris Bouchard and everybody else around the NBA response to the coming out of, what's that cat's name? Jason Collins. Okay, so that's going to be on the show today, everybody. So this is Jimmy's Underground Radio, 347-838-9825. So let's get it in. And that is track 15. It's the Bill Myers track. Yeah, it's run down.
The arrest of another, both of them Muslims. There have been calls for increased surveillance and scrutiny of the public at large and Muslims in particular. On Fox News the other day, New York Congressman Peter King said, if you know a threat is coming from a certain community, that's where you have to look. Proceed with caution here, Mr. King, and first take a look at that Council on Foreign Relations analysis of an FBI study showing that from 1980 to 2001, around two-thirds of domestic terrorism was carried out by American extremists who were not Muslims. That number actually skyrocketed to 95% in the years immediately after 9/11. And the magazine Mother Jones found that of the 62 mass shootings in America since 1982, mass killings defined as four deaths or more, 44 of the killers were white males. My guest, the journalist and columnist Glenn Greenwald, was flying here from his home in Brazil as events in Boston were unfolding. The investigation once again raised issues of civil liberties in the fight against terrorists. So we reached out to Glenn Greenwald, who as a former constitutional and civil rights litigator, keeps his critical and contrarian eye on potential conflicts between national security and individual liberty. Among his best-selling books, How Would a Patriot Act? And most recently, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Currently, Glenn Greenwald writes regularly for The Guardian. You can read him on their website. Welcome, Glenn. It's good to see you again.
Great to be back.
Was it right, in your opinion, for the suspect in Boston to be charged as a criminal rather than an enemy combatant?
Absolutely. There were very few people who even took seriously the idea that he ought to be charged as an enemy combatant for many reasons, including the fact that he's an American citizen on U.S. soil. And if there's one thing we're taught to think about our country, it's that the government can't punish people or put them in cages or threaten them with death without charging them with a crime, giving them a trial with a jury of their peers, and then convicting them beyond a reasonable doubt. But the broader question is, should we change or radically alter or dismantle our standard protocols of justice in the name of terrorism? That's been the debate we've been having since the September 11th attack, and I'm firmly in the camp that we need not and should not do that, and therefore he should be treated like any other criminal.
If it turns out that he and his brother had some significant contact with a radical organization back in their home country, would that change anything in your mind?
Well, I think that the most important thing that we need to start asking, and if that were the case, this question would become even more urgent, is why is it that there seem to be so many people from so many different parts of the world willing to risk their lives or their liberty in order to bring violence to the United States, including to random Americans whom they don't know? There has to be something very compelling that drives somebody to do that. And this was the question that was asked in the wake of the 9/11 attack, in the form of the sort of iconic question, why do they hate us? And the government needed to answer that question because people were quite rightly asking, and the answer that was fed to them was, well, they hate us for our freedom. And I think 10 years, 11 years later, people are very cynical about that answer and realize that's not really the reason, because what you see is that people from parts of the world that weren't part of 9/11 are now starting to attack the United States as well, and when they're heard, which is rare, but sometimes they are, about what their motive was, invariably they cite the fact that they had become so enraged by what Americans are doing to Muslims around the world, to their countries, in terms of bombing them, imprisoning them without charges, drone attacking them, interfering in their governments, propping up their dictators, that they feel that they have not only the right but the duty to attack America back. And so I think that the discourse then ought to really be focused on what is driving this war and how is it that we can do something that will, instead of perpetuating it further and exacerbate it further, start to think about how to undermine and dilute the sentiments that continue to fuel it, you know, 12 years after the 9/11 attacks.
You wrote the other day of America's invisible victims, and they are?
The invisible victims are the women and children and innocent men who the United States continues to kill in places like tribal regions in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia, in Afghanistan, at times in the Philippines, places throughout the Muslim world where the United States sends flying robots. We never hear about who those people are. And you can contrast it with the few instances in which the United States is attacked. We learn the names of the victims. We know their lives. We hear from how their family members are grieving. We never hear any of that in terms of the children, the women, and innocent men whom we kill in the Muslim world, and it's sort of an out-of-sight, out-of-mind dynamic where by not hearing about them, we never think about them, and by not thinking about them, we forget that they exist. And that's why when somebody attacks the United States, it leads to this bewilderment, like, well, what have we ever done to anybody that would make them want to attack us?
I think you were traveling when the Boston Seed was unfolding, is that right? When did you actually find out that it was happening?
What happened was I was flying overnight to the United States on Thursday night, which is when the shootout took place between the two brothers and the police, in which the older one was killed. And then Friday morning when I got off the plane at JFK was really the start of when people woke up and heard that there was this intense manhunt for the younger brother. And because I was traveling, I was generally in public places for the next several days, in airports, hotels, restaurants. And what I saw was everybody glued to the television in order to observe and engage with a very political event, which was this manhunt. And the reason that struck me was because there are very few events that really engage most people in the United States on a political level. Maybe there's one or two events like that every few years, maybe a national presidential election, but this was one of them.
Why do you call it a political event?
Well, it was political because it was infused with all kinds of political messages about Muslims, about radicalism, about what the proper role of the police and the military are in the United States. There were instantly these calls for greater surveillance. There was a lockdown of Boston, a very extraordinary act that a major American city would be completely locked down. What you could see in how people were observing what it was that they were watching was their political impressions about the world, about their government, about political debates being formed based on the very few incidents that they really pay attention to. And I think that's the reason why incidents like this are incredibly significant in an enduring way, because it shapes how people who don't pay much attention to politics regularly really think about the world.
And you think viewers were evaluating this manhunt that was playing out in front of them in a through political lens?
Absolutely. I mean, it's inherently the case, because when somebody does something like detonates two bombs, one of which is placed behind an 8-year-old child, which it kills, and then tears off the limbs of dozens of other people, none of whom are known to the perpetrators, the question naturally arises, why would any human being engage in that behavior? And generally, when the person is a white Christian or a white American, there's an attempt instantly to assure everybody that it's simply kind of a one-off, that it doesn't have a political content, that the person is mentally ill, that they're a lone actor, that they just snapped is usually the jargon, to assure everybody that there's no political conclusions that ought to be drawn. When the person, though, is Muslim, everything reverses. So there's no consideration to the possibility that they were mentally ill, that they simply snapped, that they were being driven by political considerations of alienation or frustration about things in their lives. Instead, there's an assumption that this bolsters the idea that we face this grave and potentially even existential threat from radical Muslims against whom we've been fighting this decade-long war, and it really bolsters the premises of that war by ratcheting up the fear levels and by reaffirming the political convictions in which it's grounded.
But you agree that terrorism is a threat and has to be dealt with, not only in trying to understand what provokes it, but in trying to prevent it.
Sure. It's the responsibility of the U.S. government to prevent its citizens from being killed and attacked in the way that they were attacked in Boston. Unfortunately, the answers that are typically offered to that question of how can the government protect us usually end up not only not protecting us but making the threat worse. So that's the problem as I see it, is that the more we react by saying, well, we now need to go bomb further with drones, we need to infiltrate and surveil more, we need to put Muslims under more of a microscope and be more aggressive in how we attack them when we think they're a threat, I think the worse this problem becomes. I think that's the problem, is that the policies justified in the name of stopping terrorism have actually done more to exacerbate that threat and to render us unsafe than any other single cause.
That raises the really deep question, the serious question of how do we thrive as an open society and become the country that we want it to become when we are faced with the knowledge that these attacks can come when and where we don't expect them.
Well, this is the problem, is that the reality is that if you have an open society, then you can't prevent attacks like this. You can build enormous structures of security to prevent people from going on airplanes with bombs or guns, but then what do you do about trains or crowded malls or Times Square? And I think then that really underscores the choice that we have, which is, number one, we can do what we've been doing, which is become a more closed society, authorize the government to read our emails, listen in our telephone calls, put people in prison without charges, enact laws that make it easier for the government to do those sorts of things. Or we can try and understand why it is that people want to come here and do that. Why are people wanting to attack the United States this way, but not dozens and dozens and dozens of countries around the world? And I think we need to get to the bottom of that question in order to figure out how to stop these attacks, is to undermine the motive.
Here in New York City this week, a lot of officials, including the police commissioner, have been saying, praising the surveillance cameras that were so helpful in Boston and saying, we need far more of those, and are asking for them. Are we moving into an era when the government is going to know more and more about each and every one of us?
We are close to that already. There was a Washington Post series in 2010 called Top Secret America, a three-part series by Dana Priest and William Arkin, and one of the facts it reported was that the National Security Agency every day collects and stores 1.7 billion, that's with a B, billion, emails, telephone calls, and other forms of electronic communications by and between American citizens. And what's amazing is that if you look at the case in Boston, the surveillance state, this massive apparatus of monitoring and storing information about us that we've constructed over the last decade that's extremely expensive and invasive, really didn't do much. It didn't detect the attack before it started. The attempted Times Square attack in 2010 wasn't stopped because of eavesdropping or government surveillance, but because a hot dog vendor noticed something amiss with the bombs that had been left. So, again, the surveillance state doesn't really do much in terms of giving us lots of security, but what it does do is it destroys the notion of privacy, which is the area in which human creativity and dissent and challenges to orthodoxy all reside. The way things are supposed to work is we're supposed to know everything that the government does, with rare exception. That's why they're called the public sector. And they're supposed to know almost nothing about us, which is why we're private individuals, unless there's evidence that we've committed a crime. This has been completely reversed so that we know almost nothing about what the government does. It operates behind this impenetrable wall of secrecy while they know everything about what it is we're doing, with whom we're speaking and communicating, what we're reading. And this imbalance, this reversal of transparency and secrecy and the way things are supposed to work has really altered the relationship between the citizenry and the government in very profound ways.
Is it conceivable to you that giving up our privacy and even much of our liberty becomes a way of life in exchange, a trade for security? Tom Brokaw suggested as much the other day. Here he is.
Everyone has to understand tonight, however, that beginning tomorrow morning early, there are going to be much tougher security considerations all across the country. However exhausted we may be by them, we're going to have to learn to live with them and get along and go forward and not let them bring us to our knees. You'll remember last summer how unhappy we were with all the security at the Democratic and Republican convention. Now I don't think that we could raise those complaints after what happened today in Boston.
I mean, I think that is, first of all, it's extraordinary that journalists lead the way in encouraging people to accept greater government intrusion into their lives. The media, journalists, are supposed to be adversarial to the government, not encouraging people to submit to greater government authority. But I think the broader point is that it's that false dichotomy that the more the government learns about us, the safer we'll be, in part because what history shows is that when governments are able to surveil people in the dark, generally the greatest outcome is that they abuse that power and it becomes tyrannical. If you talk to anybody who came from Eastern Europe, they'll tell you that the reason we left is because societies become deadened and soulless when citizens have no privacy. And it's a difficult concept to understand why privacy is so crucial. But people understand it instinctively. They put locks on their bedroom doors, not for security, but for privacy. They put passwords on their email accounts because people know that only when you can engage in behavior without being watched is that where you can explore, where you can experiment, where you can engage in creative thinking and creative behavior. A society that loses that privacy is a society that becomes truly conformist, and I think that's the real danger.
That's what happens to people in power. As you know, Henry Kissinger may have been joking back in 1975 when, off the record, although it was later transcribed, he said, the illegal we can do immediately, the unconstitutional takes a little longer.
Secrecy is the linchpin of abuse of government power. If people are able to operate in the dark, it is not likely or probable, but inevitable that they will abuse their power. It's just human nature, and that's been understood for as long as politics has existed, that transparency is really the only guarantee that we have for checking those who exercise power. And that's the reason why the government has progressively destroyed one institution after the next designed to bring transparency, whether it's the media that they've turned into these supine creatures or the Congress that does more to empower government secrecy than any other, or the courts that have been incredibly subservient to assertions of government secrecy. One of the only avenues we have left for learning what people in power do are whistleblowers, people who essentially step out and risk their individual liberty, and that's why there's such a war being waged against them.
A war being waged against whistleblowers?
There have been more prosecutions of whistleblowers under the Espionage Act, which is a 1917 statute enacted in World War I, designed to enable Woodrow Wilson to punish people who were opposed to the United States' involvement in that war. More prosecution of whistleblowers under that statute, under the Obama administration, than all previous administrations combined, just in the last 4 years, double the number, in fact. You've had people who have exposed government deceit and waste and corruption and illegality being systematically prosecuted as criminals in very harsh ways, threatened with decades in prison, being prosecuted as spies, essentially, under espionage statutes, whereas the people on whom they blew the whistles, the actual bad actors in the government, have been shielded and protected. And what this is designed to do is to send a message, as every investigative journalist in the United States will tell you, including ones who work for the most establishment newspapers, to send a message to would-be sources and whistleblowers who want to advise the public about government wrongdoing that they better think twice because they will be severely punished if they do so.
One of our best journalists, Jonathan Landay of McClatchy, has turned up evidence from government documents that President Obama and his senior aides have not been telling the truth when they claim to have only deployed drones against known senior leaders of al-Qaeda and their allies. The headline above your column on Jonathan's reporting referred to Obama administration's drone lies. Tough language.
The McClatchy article included language that the Obama administration at senior levels had misled the country and was deceitful. Because what these documents showed was that oftentimes they were targeting very low-level people whose role in these militias were unknown. They had targeted as a favor to the Pakistani government various individuals who posed no threat to the United States but who Pakistan thought had become extremists. And worst of all, the United States government has adopted what are called signature strikes, which is where, even by their own admission, they don't even know the identity of the people they're targeting, and they simply extinguish their lives without knowing who they are, but then justify it to the public by saying we're only targeting senior al-Qaeda leaders, and these leaked documents revealed how false those claims were. And again, it underscores how only leaks and whistleblowing, which the Obama administration is trying to criminalize harshly, is the way that we learn about what the government does.
You are a lawyer as well as a journalist and an essayist. What's the distinction between death by drones in a tribal area in Afghanistan and Pakistan and what the bombers did in Boston, in your mind?
I don't think there is much difference. You could certainly say that one difference, and this is what people would typically say to defend what the United States does and to distinguish it, is that we are not deliberately killing civilians while the people in Boston did. And I'm not sure how true that is. There certainly are cases where the United States has very recklessly killed civilians. But even the drone program itself, in its normal operating state, consists of a very high level of possibility that innocent people will be killed in places where there hasn't been a declared war that aren't on a battlefield, in people's homes, in their workplaces, where they congregate in their villages. And so at some point when a government engages in behavior year after year after year after year that continues to kill innocent people in a very foreseeable way and continues to do that, in my mind, that reaches a level of recklessness that is very similar to intentional killing.
You are contrarian on this because there's a reputable poll which shows that 65% of the American people support drones.
Right. I mean, this is what we were going back to a little bit earlier, which is that people have been inculcated to believe those falsehoods that the Obama administration has been propagating about drones, that they only target high-level terrorists. And when you combine that assumption, that false assumption, with the invisibility of the victims so that Americans never have to think about the human cost, both to the people we're killing and ultimately to themselves from the security threat that it produces, it's very easy to have a warped understanding of the cost and benefits. It's deliberately inducing people to view these drone attacks in a much more favorable way than reality would suggest.
So what's playing out here? Is it human nature, media, politics, propaganda, as you say, fear, all of the above?
I think it's all of the above. I mean, there have been all kinds of political theorists, statesmen, leaders, philosophers throughout history who have talked about the dangers that come from allowing a government to ratchet up fear levels by continuously focusing on external threats and enemies, that this is the greatest menace to liberty domestically. I think what ultimately happens, the worst part of it, is that when you continuously induce people to support militarism and aggression and violence by demonizing a foreign other, what you really do is you degrade the population. You transform how it is that they think, the kind of people that they are, the things that they come to expect from life. You really make it a much more savage and bloodthirsty populace that will then support things that in the absence of that sustained propaganda, they would find horrific. And I think you see lots of examples of that in American discourse.
Do you see long-range implications from what happened in Boston?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the most amazing things to me over the last few years was in the aftermath of our killing of Osama bin Laden, there was all kinds of chanting and marching and celebratory dancing taking place in the street, which was striking to me because even if you believe that the killing of Osama bin Laden was justifiable, anytime you're killing somebody and dumping their corpse into the ocean, that should be a cause of somber reflection, even if you believe it was necessary. And I think you saw much of the same thing in Boston. Again, the chanting and the sense of collective self-esteem and the reverence for military and political police institutions, I think is very disturbing and will really endure.
But then couldn't it have been just relief? Relief that they had found the other guy, that they didn't have to go to bed that night wondering if another bomb would go off?
Sure. I think that relief is a natural reaction, just like I think that relief from the killing of Osama bin Laden is natural. He had been this sort of hovering menace for so long. But the way in which this was all done, both in Boston and then the killing of Osama bin Laden, is something that is a very extreme form of government behavior and of police force and of military power. But ultimately what I really think more than anything else, and this is I think what the most profound point is from all of this, is I remember the night that Osama bin Laden was killed and President Obama went on television and said, this shows, again, that any time America sets its mind to something, our greatness allows us to achieve it. And the reason why that was so striking to me was because it used to be the case that as a country, what gave us our sense of nationalistic pride was going to the moon or discovering new cures for diseases or inventing technologies that elevated the lives of hundreds of millions of people around the world. And I think that the way in which Americans now relate to their government, that the way in which they get nationalistic pride is through the assertion of this massive military or police force, and very few other things produce that kind of pride, I think shows a lot about our value system and what the government is failing to do. And that's the way in which this culture becomes coarsened.
It's been good to see you again. I wish you a safe trip home.
Thank you.
That was Glenn Greenwald on the Bill Maher Show. You can find it on PBS. Something to think about. Well, I got a couple more minutes before I get to the top of the hour. Let me give you something else to think about.
Should we begin to profile white males? Now, I know this is a very controversial topic and a very controversial issue to talk about. And whenever you talk about profiling based on someone's race, based on someone's gender, based on someone's nationality or their beliefs, it always goes into highly sensitive areas. But what I'd like all of you to do is to please hear me out until the end of the video, when you hear all my points being laid out on the table, and then you can decide for yourself what you think about the issue. Now, at the end of the day, folks, I firmly believe that we need to keep political correctness at the door. At the end of the day, we have a security risk. We have a danger and a threat to society, to all of us, to innocent people. So when you have a threat to security, I'm sorry, but you need to keep political correctness at the door and national security at the forefront. So let's lay our sensitivities to the side. So the PC Brigade, I'm sorry, but, you know, we're just going to have to talk about the facts. But continue to hear me out until the end. Now, over the past month, there have been a series of deadly shootings in America. You had the shooting in Colorado in which a guy attacked a cinema, killing 12 people. This was shortly followed by another shooting massacre that took place in Wisconsin at a Sikh temple, which left 6 people dead. Now, if you recall, there was another deadly shooting last summer in Norway at a summer camp. Over 60 people were shot dead by Anders Breivik, and it was one of the deadliest terrorist attack to have hit Norway. Now, in all of these attacks, there is a pattern: the use of a gun and the angry white male. Now, it's no secret, folks, that such shooting sprees, shooting massacres, are mainly a phenomena of white males. That's the type of attack you usually find white males conducting, going into a crowded area and shooting as many people. I mean, in 1999, I'm just giving you examples, another shooting attack in Colorado, the Columbine shootings, which left several students dead, again, committed by white men or white youth, teenagers. So this is a pattern we find mainly being exercised by white people, shooting attacks in crowded areas. And is it time to begin profiling white people based on these attacks? And I think the answer is yes. I think we need to begin profiling white males from the ages of 16 to 50. I think that would be fair enough. And again, you know, you can be sensitive about the issue, but we all know about the shootings that happen at colleges, that happen at schools, and that is always mainly done by white people. Now, there's always the exception. There's always going to be an exception. But now what we're starting to see is that they're broadening their targets: a cinema, a summer camp in Norway, and now a Sikh temple. And there's many other places that they've attacked. I mean, in 2009 or 2010, I believe, a Jewish Holocaust museum was also attacked by an angry white gunman. And the list goes on. Even at the workplace, there's a lot of angry white people who have often shot up the place when they were angry. You know, the angry employee. And so these are traits mainly committed by white people. And we have the whole empirical evidence to back it up. And just look at the past month. 2 deadly shootings, 2 major shooting sprees conducted by a white person. So the threat is there, folks. This is not disputed. And so in the name of national security, in our interests to protect our children, we need to start profiling white males. I mean, I know it's probably going to be a bit of an inconvenience, but sensitivities aside, people are dying. And if you ask me, I think it's a moral obligation to protect people's lives rather than protecting people's sensitivities. At the end of the day, if your feelings are hurt, that's all good. But if you're dead, there's no coming back from that. If your feelings are hurt, you can go to Starbucks and buy yourself a coffee or go to the cinema and be happy. Unless another white person comes to that cinema or to that Starbucks and shoots the place up. So what do you think? Now here's the main point. I told all of you to listen till the end. Now you see, everything I just said is a load of crap. Everything I just said was a load of rubbish nonsense, which I don't even believe in. I don't even believe in none of that nonsense. But nonetheless, everything I just said is being said on mainstream platforms by people concerning Muslims, Middle Easterners, blacks, and Hispanics. The same type of arguments that are used to try to support Muslim profiling or Middle Eastern profiling or black profiling or Hispanic profiling are the very same arguments, the very same type of empirical evidence I just brought up to you. And the fact of the matter is, if I was truly arguing that we should profile white people, if I was really being sincere about the first 5 minutes of this video, people would be outraged. They would say, you know, what are you talking about? That's unacceptable. But yet, it is acceptable to go on mainstream programs, mainstream platforms, and bring up the idea that it is okay and it is necessary to profile Muslims and Middle Easterners. And it's not just your average Joe who's calling for it. Rick Santorum. Do you remember Rick Santorum? This guy is part of the American government. He was running for the American presidency, and he openly called for Muslim profiling. You know, if you're a Muslim, you know, you're the guys who are mainly doing the attacks, so yeah, we got to profile you. And then there's other many platforms where you find other mainstream people calling for profiling of black people and Hispanic people, you know, because of gang violence and what have you. So why is it acceptable when it comes to Muslims and Middle Easterners and blacks and Hispanics? Why isn't now the same topic being done for white people? But you see how silly it sounds. You see how stupid it sounds. When you put the term, we should profile white people based on the arguments I gave, you see how silly it sounds. But if you replace white with Muslim, or white with black, or white with Hispanic, all of a sudden people will say, you know what, that actually makes a lot of sense. And so all I'm trying to do, folks, is show you the double standards and to show you how stupid such arguments sound.
Another issue I want to address is, are Caucasians now going to be profiled? I mean, it's fascinating. Now that we have white perpetrators in the Boston Marathon bombing, their whiteness has become completely irrelevant. White is never used in describing the suspects. It was not addressed in any of the press conferences I saw that we have a manhunt for a white individual. I didn't hear it. I think maybe there was one instance where one official mentioned it, right? I mean, white American Muslim bombers. Nobody ever thought about this possibility. Natan, nobody even considered this could be a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any mystery as to what's going on. I mean, it's the people of color are considered an other. They're labeled as such. That's how people talk about them. The sort of default standard, whether it's explicit or implicit, is that you're white and probably that you're Christian. So this is like the standard. We all know this. That's why it's reported as such.
Sikh American activist and filmmaker Valerie Kaur pointed out another example of the double standard, which actually David Sirota described quite a bit. He said, let's remember that the Oak Creek mass shooting was actually the last incident of domestic terrorism in this country. It was committed by a white supremacist who walked into a Sikh house of worship. We did not hear calls for white people to be profiled. We did not hear Christianity denigrated or Christians living in fear. The way that our country diagnoses a problem when it's a white perpetrator is that it's an individual problem. I think this is an interesting thing. I mean, there are so many other pressing issues with this case, and they're being discussed, but I think it's interesting to talk about. We have two white perpetrators here, and all of a sudden their whiteness is just not a factor.
Well, it's easy to profile a minority, right? Because there's fewer of them.
Sure.
They're the ones who stick out in a crowd. So how do you profile white people? I mean, it seems like such a huge undertaking that it wouldn't even be worth the effort on any front. Of course, I'm not saying that profiling people of other races is worth the effort, obviously.
No, but just in the context of how this has been carried out.
Right.
The other thing that's interesting is that we're also talking about them in the context of immigrants, right? And I find it interesting because one an American citizen, one close to being an American citizen. How far after you've come into this country is the fact that you came from another country a factor? I mean, let's think about me, right? I came to this country when I was 5. I became a citizen when I was 17. If I now committed an act of terror, what would be pointed at, right? What would be pointed at? Would it be listen, this is a guy who came into this country. Clearly, our immigration system did not work well because we didn't identify him. We didn't stop him. This guy was running around our country, and then he committed this act of terror. That's another framing, I think, that is interesting, which is the this is because these guys aren't from the U.S. And how far does that work? I don't know. I'm asking the question.
Well, we know how the corporate media works, right?
We do.
They would say, yes, this is clearly something that needs to be looked at. They'd say, well, let's look at the parents. Let's look at the grandparents.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's look at the parents. Let's look at the grandparents. What's the world coming to? Are we willing to give up our security for our freedom? I mean, you know, like I talked about yesterday, blacks been profiled, been moved around. You know, we've been under the New World Order thumb for a minute. It just gives something to pause and think about. You know, if you want to chime in on it, you can always call 347-838-9825. But let's take a quick break right about now. And why don't you go to some George Benson, Nature Boy.
Was a boy, every strange enchanted boy, say he wandered very far, very far, over land and sea, little shy inside of our. Way. As we spoke of many things, ruled and came, this he said to me, greatest thing you could ever learn, just to be loved. Thank you.
9825. Yes, the farmer definitely walks in the building, Ebony. Just let you the farmer for a second. You do get a call in. Let me bring this call in before I go on. Chris Bouchard and what's that guy named, Ebony? Jason Collins. What's going on? Let me bring my man in right now. What it is, Cleveland? What it do? How's you, Ebony? He just hangs the phone like that. Right on. Now I got it now. What up? How you doing?
I'm all right. I'm all right. I see you got your question. Should we give up our privacy for increased security? I think they're increasing the security whether we like it or not, whether we want to give it up or not. You know, they had drones at the marathon game. Thing.
Right. So I mean, but are you?
I didn't know. Huh?
There's no protest. There's no protest. It's like, are we welcoming it or are we cool with it? You know, are we cool with it or what? You know, what's the deal?
Are we cool with it?
Yeah. Are you cool with it?
I mean, no, I'm not cool with it, but it's going to happen whether we're cool with it or not. Because, I mean, I don't see nothing happening. I don't see nobody protesting.
But then again,
why do they have to have drones over here? What's the need for all this increased security? You know, what's happening? What's really happening?
Saying now since we caught the bombers with cameras.
Oh, because I'm just saying they had another thing, another drone thing. They got these little drones that are like birds. And it's like they roll in packs. And they show them going inside, you know, buildings and stuff like that. It's some little drones now. They're going to have them, you know, they look like little flocks of birds.
Well, they have drones here in Chicago right now trying to spot on crime. We have drones here. I don't know, it's something the mayor, the city council, it's something that people, the elected official decides to put in the constituency does not know nothing, and they let this shit just roll off their tongue like the word constituency just roll off mine. Ha ha ha. But no one does nothing. Freedom goes. It was a line in Star Wars, the new version, the next three, not the first three. Princess Pat once said that freedom goes with applause and a stroke of a pen, because people applaud freedom away. They come out and say we need more cameras because we caught the terrorists. We need more drones out there to monitor to the terrorists, because in actuality they got us on lock. They got the colored man on lockdown, regardless of the fact. So they got to be able to monitor the European, because if you look at the
Or is it that we outnumber them and they're scared?
Well, I can't speak on us outnumber them.
I'm looking at it from a strategy point of view. They're the minority. And they got a history that, you know, the people don't like them, and they know that. So I just figure, since we know we're the minority, and they know that we know we're the minority, I guess they fear an uprising.
Well, I don't know about no uprising because we all Americans, but I'm going to come in here like this. The simple fact that they now that the bombers were Caucasian coming from the Caucasus Mountains, you know, over there in Chechnya and Bosnia, over there is bombing Russia.
I mean, they were set up, man. They were set up.
You think they're set up or not? Now you got the Caucasian man being the face of terror now. You know, they're the ones that are going in these schools shooting up people. They're the ones that are going in these theaters shooting up people. They're the ones doing the Columbine. They're the ones blowing these things up. You know, so now, how are you going? I mean, the drones are not necessarily for the person of color because, hey, you can't go two blocks without a cop stopping you saying, where you going? Where your ID at? Who are you? Every black man ain't going to leave a house with no ID because he might go to jail for something he didn't do. Every black man know that. You know, every black man going to walk to the airport and get pulled out. Every black man know that. Every black man know that the police going to pull you over for no reason at all. Every black man know
but,
that.
But. Black man, folks live in the cities. Black folks live in the cities.
Let me tell you something. They know there's no search and seizure. I just watched this TV show a minute ago called
okay.
The Following.
They ain't, worried about the they ain't out in the rural areas watching the white folks. That's where all that stuff happened.
Well, let me give you an example.
That's what a drone should be.
I watched this TV show called The Following. It was Kevin Costner about this coach stuff, what have you. But here's a good scene where this lady was buried in some so she was buried underground in a coffin, what have you. He had to get to her, so he finally got to her. Lady was there. But anyway, so the dude who they told them where the body was at, they took the man to a barn. It was the FBI. The FBI beating somebody up, beating the man down to a bloody pulp. Yeah, yeah. Now, you as the people sitting back at the crib, you're going to be cheering them. Yeah, yeah. Beat it down. You got to save the girl. You got to save the girl. Go beat his ass, you know. But here you are beating an American citizen. Yeah, the dude was a criminal. Yes, he was a criminal. You know. But he was an American citizen, but here is the police, here's the FBI beating the citizen up in the end, they're killing the guy. But here you are, here we are as a society watching them, cheering them on. We watch every night, we watch Jing Jong Law and Order, all these cop shows, the cops sitting there, you know, there's no search and seizure. You know, they go to somebody, a perp house or somebody on probation, they want to plant drugs. You know you're planting drugs on you, hey man, give me some information, slap you around. I mean, we see police beating up people on a daily basis till it's a norm. To the point where we know that our rights are not even there. I mean, have we given it up that far? I mean, we can go back to Starsky and Hutch. You know, police woman. Every police show, you got the cops beating down somebody, crib coming in. There's no search warrant. In Boston, you had the first practice of martial law where people can go door to door, the government go door to door, kicking in your house without asking for a search warrant. And no one is protesting that. There's a lot of little test things happening, but no one is screaming. But everybody said, let's get the killer, but yet, What I learned, after that whole little drama played out on TV, I learned one thing, that Boston need a new police force right now because they cannot shoot. That's all I got to say. They cannot aim, they cannot fire, they cannot shoot. So whatever we can want to say, we can say this, that they need to hit the range, and they need to hit the range fast. Because if you can't hit a man, if a man can come out alive in a boat and he's getting riddled with bullets, then you need to arrange quickly and fast, you know, because there's no way it should have came out alive, you know, the way the bullets was riddled. Now, the way he did, you know, not saying that they should have killed the individual. I'm not trying to wish death on any harm because I'm glad.
Well, that's what they was going to do to him, even though they kept saying they wanted him alive.
I'm glad America did not use force, but be alive. But if you saw, you can pull up on the internet. I have not seen it, but you know, I saw some quick news flashes. I just took away, but all you can hear is. I mean, hell.
So
the black policeman who went on a rampant man, they took his ass out easily. Boom, burnt his ass up. No problem whatsoever. But here comes the average looking white boy. I mean, the average straight out of casting. You put glasses on him, he's a nerd. Put some Abercrombie and Fitch, he's somebody from Cleveland. You know what I'm saying? East Cleveland. You know what I'm saying? He can fit right in. Even if he got out of Boston, you never saw him again. You never saw him again. Cut his hair, what up? When we watch, cut him, what? He's gone. Now you got a profile. We got a 5'11", 6'2", white guy, curly hair, freckles, pecker nose. I mean, what the hell? You can't do that. So you got to get him now, because if he escapes, what are we going to do now?
Hey, I know you can make a statement when you were, like, under duress.
window. I didn't know police can come in your house without a search warrant.
I mean, you know, dude just came up under anesthesia, whatever, and of course she was in pain, and they say he made a statement saying I'm the bomber.
Well, I don't know. That's why a judge came in. He had a lawyer to make sure none of those things.
No, they said he had a public defender.
No matter what, he still had legal representation, and a judge made sure that was happening.
Yeah.
You know, we can dance the dance, but in the end, I can throw that bomb right at you, and the next bomb where he had the judge and lawyer came out there, and that's why everybody's angry because he got Mirandarized. How you gonna Mirandarize him? What the fuck? He's an American citizen. You see, you hear the outcry. The outcry is American citizen has no rights. Again, I say, you watch this little TV show, The Following, go on there and Hulu, Google it. If y'all saw it today, I mean, yesterday it was almost a climactic ending. I think it was a show ending. The season ender. But anyway, you see the FBI just beating somebody down. You can watch 24, you watch any stuff, you have no rights as a citizen because you have nobody that is speaking up for your rights at all. We can sit there and fight it, but are we writing our congressmen? Are we writing our senators? Are we writing our governors? Are we writing our elected officials that
okay, now you can write them, and what they're supposed to do?
Go on record.
Go on record what? I mean, the military is running things now. Martial law means they're in control.
Well, there it is.
No more civil rights. That's out the door.
But say it. Let's not play it.
Well, they're putting it in action. They're testing it. Test it here, test it there, test it here.
It was Boston, and no one screamed. Hey, you know, the bomber there, nah, you're lying. Boom, hey, man, he's not in here. You know, you mean to tell me you can kick in my door, police, without a warrant? What's up with the seizure?
Well, they put Boston in a blackout, you know. No internet, no cell phones, no nothing, no TV, nothing.
And
so they did what they wanted to do.
Was not a test of an African-American neighborhood. Why? Because most niggas ain't got no cell phones, internet, none of that shit anyway. And, you know, barely living on somebody's electricity outside regardless of the fact. You black them out, that ain't shit. But black someone else who depends on the internet system like most middle-class Americans do. You go to lower-class neighborhood, shit, they barely got the net. They barely got cable. You know, they barely got the black box to get the digital converter. You know, what I'm saying is the haves are not used to being in this system. I played a scene, a little tape earlier that was taken like 3 days after the bomber where this little white boy said, you know, hey, he came to America like three or five years old and he became a citizen at 17. And, you know, if he done something where they say, hey, look, we should let this guy in. He's a white guy. All of a sudden, let's look what transpired. We can cut down the DREAM Act now. We can cut down the Immigration Reform Bill Act right now because if we pass this immigration law for these Mexicans, we're going to let all these Caucasian terrorists in. So no more immigration. And now
I'm going to ask you, the Pope, he's an astrophysicist.
Okay.
I was watching, you know, my mom had a station on. I was watching his church channel. They talk about the Vatican. Is now watching, looking in the telescope for extraterrestrials, UFOs. Thinking about. Huh?
They say the Vatican's supposed to prepare. Watch these churches supposed to prepare everybody for some what this new extraterrestrial teaching. So what do you know about the aliens coming back on this planet Earth? Why don't you break it down, my listeners, down to that?
Well, I don't know anything. I'm just going on what they said. See what you know. What I'm saying. If that's the case, then. All this putting drones in place because they don't know how people are going to react when they come out and tell them, hey, your religion is false.
Well, how about this? America
don't
have them. We're not a religious country whatsoever. We're not a religious country. That's the thing.
Yeah, they are. Are we? Yeah.
Let me take one little break. I'll put you on hold for 1 second. I have to take a commercial break. I'm going to park it to half an hour. This is 347-838-9825. This is Jimmy Lee's Underground Radio Network. Ebony, why don't you go ahead and prop us up for the next break? Because that leads right to what he was talking about. And I want to prove to him how the American society, I don't think we might have it up. Let me see. Against the government. Well, go to commercial. Just go to commercial, then we come back with that. How we are not an American religious country anymore.
Partners in Community Building focuses on credit building, financial literacy, and home ownership for residents throughout Chicago and Illinois. All of our services are free. Call 312-328-0873 to get additional information on our homeownership counseling, rental assistance, Cook County foreclosure mediation, and small accessible repairs for seniors programs. PCIB is a HUD-certified nonprofit counseling agency committed to addressing the housing needs of all people. Call 312-328-0873 to schedule an appointment or visit us at www.pcibchicago.org.
I've been waiting for some team player to come out for years. It happens now in the NBA. Chris, people have been waiting for some team player to come out for years. It happens now in the NBA. So what impact does today's news have on the league?
Well, I've been texting and talking with dozens of players, GMs, coaches, agents, former players from the 80s and 90s, and the thing, there's a mixed bag of reactions. I've heard everything. But what everyone seems to agree on is that you're going to hear very little criticism of Jason Collins, because a lot of people agree, as you said, Kobe Bryant, Steve Nash, people like that. But a lot of people understand it's a politically correct climate, and even players that don't agree will not necessarily voice that opinion because they understand the climate. I've had some players say that they would be uncomfortable with a gay player in the locker room, particularly showering with a guy. But, again, no one's going to come out and necessarily say anything. I've had other players who, like Kobe and Nash and Baron Davis, have been completely supportive. As far as general managers, it depends on if the guy can play. Jason's a free agent. He's 34. He's toward the end of his career. He's a, you know, third-string center anyway at this point. If he doesn't get signed next year, it probably won't be because of he came out as gay, just because, you know, he's toward the end of his career and not that good anymore. But GM said they'll have to consider the locker room. The use of the locker room is a factor in terms of how players will accept this. I've been told that. If they're young and immature, there may be more of a level of unacceptance. So there are a lot of things that I've heard. One great point was made to me that a player like this, if it's Jason, if he plays next year, could become alienated a little bit in the locker room because some players, if they're close to him, their sexuality may be questioned. So, like I said, it's kind of like the United States of America as a whole. You've got many different opinions.
Well, it's interesting, the timing of the announcement. It comes after Jason Collins' season is over, so there's several months allowed for this news to sink in before he has to step foot back in an NBA locker room again. Do you get the feeling, like we may have seen the last of Jason Collins? I'm reading between the lines here, Chris, and what you're saying. It sounds like, all things being equal, it may be somewhat of a black mark against him staying in the league. If you got him going up against another player, and the other player hasn't come out as being gay, it might just be the easier path to take that other player. Is that what I'm hearing?
No. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying there's different views. You know, the front office people are going to look at this as, you know, how it affects my locker room. Can he still play? The point I'm trying to make is that it'd be different if Jason was 24. And, you know, when he was 24, I remember he played with the Nets team that went to the finals. He was definitely an NBA-caliber player and starter in some cases at that point in his career. He didn't play much this year. Even if he had not come out, there's a possibility he may not have been re-signed next year. So I don't think this will have any impact on whether he's signed. If he's not signed, I don't think it'll be because of his sexuality. But I am saying that I've heard a mixed bag of reactions. Not everyone has been like Kobe or Steve Nash. Some players have, like I said, they disagree with it, could play with him as a teammate, but would feel a little bit uncomfortable in the locker rooms and showers and things like that. So, like I said, it's just a mixed bag. If you're a GM of a team that's young or has players like that, then that's something you may have to consider.
A lot of us have lost track of Jason Collins as an NBA player. We know he's well-respected in the league. He's a Stanford grad. How suited is he to be the standard bearer for the gay athlete in the NBA?
Well, this is one thing I've heard, too, from everyone has agreed on this. He's a great guy. He is upstanding, high basketball IQ, was a tough player. No one has said anything bad about him. He has the utmost respect from players and GMs and coaches that I've spoken with, even ones that may disagree with his lifestyle. He's obviously intelligent, having played at Stanford. So I think he's great in that regard. Now, he's not a star. He never was a star, and that lessens it a little bit. I mean, if this was an all-star, perennial all-star, a superstar coming out, it would have more of an impact. It would be earth-shattering. At this point, you know, because he was just a mediocre player, I think it lessens the impact just a little bit.
That's not the one I wanted to get to, Anthony. The one I wanted to get to was the one questioning his religion on the situation, because that was someone I wanted to lead into that piece with Sean. Are you still on? Yeah. Not too long.
Yeah.
Okay. That was another piece that I'm going to be trying to play. Get the one where you're talking about his religion aspect and why he is tripping on it. You can find that one.
Obviously, you, as a progressive, you believe that gay people should be equal and there should be gay NBA players and all that stuff.
So.
How do you balance between that and then the people, the Bible thumpers, and we're going to get to some of that in just a second, but I want to leave the clip by, how do you decide to present something in a somewhat fair way when you pretty much know what you think about it and
right.
want to argue for equality?
Well, I try to educate people about their religions because nobody ever reads actual books, right? So, and I don't want to be too denigrating, et cetera, because I know a lot of people of faith. My mom is a person of faith. She happens to be Muslim, right? But, you know, but I love her, and I,
And I get that it comes from a good place for a lot of people, but they just don't actually know what's in the book. So in the same verse in Leviticus that you shall not lie with a man as you lie with a woman, it also says you should not eat shellfish. And everybody's eating shrimp, lobster, unless they're allergic or something. And so immediately they have this moment of like, oh, my God, wait, am I gay? Have I done something as bad as the gays? Right? And they almost don't believe it. And then when they go read it, they're like, oh, wow, why did we take the gay part and go ballistic over it, and we don't talk about the shellfish at all? Why is there no red lobster amendment?
The leaders of the church picking and choosing what they want to preach about.
And you guys have given me a perfect segue to our first clip. This is Chris Broussard on ESPN's Outside the Lines earlier today.
I don't agree with homosexuality. I think it's a sin, as I think all sex outside of marriage between a man and a woman is. And LZ knows that. He and I have played on basketball teams together for several years. We've gone out, had lunch together. We've had good conversations, good laughs together. He knows where I stand, and I know where he stands. I don't, you know, criticize him. He doesn't criticize me and call me a bigot, call me ignorant, call me intolerant. And that I hear, and talking to some people around the league, there are a lot of Christians in the NBA, and they don't want to be, just because they disagree with that lifestyle, they don't want to be viewed and called bigoted and intolerant and things like that. And that's what LZ was getting at. Just like I may tolerate someone whose lifestyle I disagree with, he can tolerate my beliefs, and he disagrees with my beliefs and my lifestyle, but true tolerance and acceptance is being able to handle that as mature adults and not criticize each other and call each other names.
So the LZ that he's talking about is LZ Granderson, who's an ESPN columnist, who is openly gay, and I find this clip fascinating because it goes to what you're talking about, Cenk, about the way people use the Bible, because he's also, there's an implication in what he's saying that somehow his feelings are as equal as the gay person's feelings, except only one of those two people, in this case, Jason Collins or LZ Granderson, only one of those people doesn't have equal rights, so it doesn't seem like it adds up to me.
Exactly. Now, why did I thought I could go that route, Sean, if you still out there listening? I went that route because of this. If you believe in what Chris Broussard believes, because he's a Christian, and that lifestyle is conflicting with your religious belief, should you tolerate that? You know, I don't eat pork, you know. I tolerate people eating pork, but I don't go around them when they eat pork. I don't eat in their cribs because they eat pork. And, you know, and this I know. I choose not to go out eat with certain people or drink certain people because things I don't drink and, you know, like that. I tolerate a lot of people. But it's not about tolerance. It's about, has this land became a place where being a Christian or believer in God, skip the Christianity part, a believer in God, and what his teachings was supposed to be given in the Bible, Torah or Quran, you're now being attacked. So when I say that this is not like a God-fearing place no more, you have Christians fighting Muslims, Muslims fighting Jews. Now you have homosexuals saying that their rights are just as equal to that as an African American, that I'm being discriminated, I can't get married like blacks can get married. Blacks could get married just like blacks and whites can get married. There was no discrimination in blacks and whites getting married, or a black and white couple going down. That was just not no discrimination. That was a fear of genetic annihilation from a race. Now, what's the fear of homosexual marriage to some people? They feel that is the annihilation of the human race because there's no productivity. What I mean, productivity, you can't produce. There's no reproductive action. And that's why it goes to the point I think they'd be saying, but now what we're going to be hearing is people attacking Christianity. Again, let me play a Chris Broussard cut for you one more time so you understand what we're trying to say here. Hear them again, Abby. Got it.
He mentioned in his article, Jason, that he is a Christian as well. So what's your take on that?
Personally, I don't believe that you can live an openly homosexual lifestyle or an openly premarital sex between heterosexuals. If you're openly living that type of lifestyle, then the Bible says you know them by their fruits. It says that, you know, that's a sin. And if you're openly living in unrepentant sin, whatever it may be, not just homosexuality, adultery, fornication, premarital sex between heterosexuals, whatever it may be, I believe that's walking in open rebellion to God and to Jesus Christ. So I would not characterize that person as a Christian because I don't think the Bible would characterize him as a Christian.
LZ, your response?
Well, my response is that faith, just like love, just like marriage, is personal. And that if you try to use a broad brush to paint everyone's faith, what you really are painting is a world in which it's comfortable for you and not a world in which, in this country, we're allowed various forms of religion. And just because someone doesn't agree with one person's interpretation of the Bible versus the other doesn't mean that they have the exclusive rights to dictate what that person, how that person should live. I would love not to have premarital sex, but in this country, I'm not allowed to get married.
When were you last on an amazing vacation? I'm Tracy Lewis, leisure travel specialist with Pogo World Travel, and I'm here to tell you that you don't have to go it alone when planning the vacation of a lifetime. So the next time you're looking for expert advice on that perfect vacation, you've got Pogo World Travel every step of the way. Visit our website at gowithpogo.com today and find out why they say, go with Pogo World Travel and discover your dream of vacation come true.
Tired, stressed out, or just need me or we time? Then Phoenix Rising, Baltimore's exclusive bed and breakfast, is the place for you. Phoenix Rising offers an unforgettable, rejuvenating experience with exquisite guest rooms. Find peace and calm in the Sedona Room or Haitian Room, or relax in front of a marble fireplace in the Serengeti Room. Call 410-462-2692 today to schedule your escape to Phoenix Rising. Visit us online at phoenixrising.com.
Do you hear that sound? Well, that's the sound of back pain. Are you tired of nagging and persistent back pain? Whether you're suffering from a chronic condition or a recent injury, don't fret. Chiropractic has proven to be a natural and holistic alternative to pain medications and surgical procedures. Visit Dr. Todd Tucker at our Water Tower location on Chicago's Magnificent Mile for a free consultation and exam. Call 888-535-2381 to get started with your personalized treatment plan. That's 888-535-2381. Call now.
Black Ink Incorporated presents Valentine's Day New School Old School Hip Hop Music Thursday.
And every Thursday at Pulaski Hall,
West Hunting Park Ave, across from Grant High School. Doors open at 8 p.m.
$3 shot drinks, $5 mixed drinks,
$10 admission. Ladies, you're free before 11. 25 and over with ID a must. Free light buffet. Upstairs, a live performance from Montana Black and the sounds of DJ Smooth.
Valentine's Day New School Old School Hip Hop Music Thursday.
And every Thursday at Pulaski Hall, West Hunting Park Ave, across from Grant High School. Relax downstairs and chill.
Mingle and have uninterrupted conversations.
25 and over with ID a must. $3 shot drinks, $5 mixed drinks, $10 admission. It's New School Old School Hip Hop Music Thursday at Pulaski Hall,
West Hunting Park Ave, across from Grant High School.
Another Black Ink Incorporated production.
Got your black coffee at the Jazz Cafe. Got your mocha at the Jazz Cafe. Got your latte at the Jazz Cafe. At the Jazz Cafe. At the Jazz Cafe. Got your black coffee at the Jazz Cafe. Got your mocha at the Jazz Cafe. Got your latte at the Jazz Cafe. At the Jazz Cafe. At the Jazz Cafe. The Jazz Cafe is one of the main distributors of the Organo Gold Coffee. It gives natural energy delivered right to your doorstep. If you want to order your coffee today, contact Shauna at 601-918-2079 or go to 601jazzcafe.organogold.com. Got your black coffee at the Jazz Cafe. Got your mocha at the Jazz Cafe. Got your latte at the Jazz Cafe. At the Jazz Cafe. At the Jazz Cafe. Got your black coffee at the Jazz Cafe. Got your mocha at the Jazz Cafe. Got your latte at the Jazz Cafe. At the Jazz Cafe. At the Jazz Cafe.
you lost my man, Sean, but I'll play that whole Chris Broussard interview probably tomorrow for you all people out there, and we can see what's up with it, and we can judge from that point on. I don't want to give nobody no sound bites. But that's all. And the morning after pill has just been appreciated. So the dragon's eating the babies on the spot, just talking stuff to everybody. Hey, Sean, producer said this is for you.
Caveman.
You better
push. Cave women. Push. Neanderthal.
Push.
Troglodytes.
Somebody's calling my name.
To the east, my brother, to the east, come on.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east, yeah.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, 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 to the east.
Yes, I'm that kind of nigga. The one you fear, be scared, you can't figure. The one that has the finger on the trigger, boom. In the cut, in the darkness, the halo, the moon. Step into your real soon. Ah, check the blackness. Me before those actors of lightness. Masturbating, masquerading, and you'll call yourself righteous. Follow me, a peripheral missionary and dark witness. Having intercourse with a nation of darkness. Books with worms, Jerry's with last names like Burns. Niggas, get your hands off your crack, come to terms with yourself. And if you don't get any bigger, pink caddy driving black boots stomping. Yes, I'm that kind of nigga. Brother J, what you say? Brother J, what you say? Brother J, what you say? Brother J, what you say?
Yeah, I'm just a pro black nigga and I'm doing this. And you have to watch me, clock me to see if I continue this. In the ways of the caddy, I survive like a pimp. No jerry curls, wave perms or crimps. The ever nappy fool set in the mood. I raise my fuel for my firm attitude. Walking through the streets with my war cry spear. Certain folks know what means doom when they hear. My firm black boots and no spurs attached. But let me give a second cause I might detach ya. My black boots if you confused. I lose my peoples in the words you choose. Provider, what's wrong, my man, what you think? Except my back, so how the hell you just tank? The front page, cause outrage. There's no gauge cause it's time for the Mac. Tune in your radio, video, stereo and all that. To the vibes of the pro-black. It's like that as I wind up my wrist. Check out the smack of the scientific fist. Born on level to the east I flow. Cause of freedom or death, there's no choice, you know. Still on the topic of the PRO. On the path of verbs, fix your brother PXO.
Over and under as I progress to this. Got no time to be hanging out with humanists. Raise a flag, five the tag, the hand, clutch the fist. Serving nationally comes for this. Humanity keep us witness, we bread eaters. Milwaukee the brutality, how can you dismiss? So, off to the road we go, you know. Follow the pro nigga flow. Off to the road, you know we go. Follow the pro nigga flow. For you and yours, legislation. Past purpose agitation. By way of the old world emancipation. Zoom, 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 revelation. Cometh pro black dedication. The solution, revolution, evolution, the conclusion, the trigger. Please elect by take a swigger. And if you don't get any bigger, yes, I'm that kind.
Yeah, revolution, evolution, the solution. No amendments and burn the constitution. You check the authors, a bunch of old wiggers who strategize the extension of the pro black niggas. Know why? Cause I'm that nigga that they can't stand. They teach the African how to say black man. I remember green suits on a black mayor. I remember 9mm child slayers. I remember all the times that you call me an animal. But in Milwaukee, there's a cannibal. Check it. Some of the things that you just don't figure. Cause it gets a lot blacker and a whole lot bigger. No matter nice, thick, or bring your brick trigger. Our nation is protected by some pro black niggas.
Making note of some minors. I'm not talking baseball, because if I was, Brother J, we'd be playing professional. You're
9 innings to a baseball game. By the way, is it humanity or is it vanity? Vainglorious. This is protected by the red, the black, and the green. With a key on the road again. City. And you don't stop.
Man, you can never go no wrong with X-Clan. You can never go wrong with X-Clan. I haven't heard X-Clan since back in the cassette day. So please forgive me, man, if I be X-Clan out one day. You know, sometimes when you're digging your crates, man, you hear the music you used to listen to and wonder what happened to music like that. But anyway, now it shines what you believe in. If you believe, it's going to come down to which side are you on. Everybody want to make a choice. You know, everybody's going to have to make a choice in this world we're living in. Tomorrow, like I said, I'm going to try to get that Chris Rashad interview on Outside the Lines. That's the one I wanted to play the whole one. We had instead of sound bites and snippets that I played. So you can see what the battle is. And for my gay friends, you know, everybody got gay friends, like everybody got black friends, like everybody got white friends. My gay friends out there, this ain't no shit out, no diss. Call in and let's talk about it. To my gay Christian friends, those ones who ain't came out, since your boy come out, why don't you call about it? Call about it, talk about it. You know, because who's down for God in the end? Who stands for man? In the end, who witnessed for Jesus? In the end, all depends on what you believe in. If you believe, you know. And to those who believe, to taking a death of a martyr's death, is that a wrong death to believe? Or to those who believe in an afterlife, die for something that they know is an afterlife, such as the Christian martyrs that might come to fruition that they die and there's nothing what they say where they deaf in vain. But those look at those who put down and say there's nothing afterwards. Why are you doing that? It all depends on what you believe and how strong is your faith. Is that faith of mustard seed stuff? Is that real talk or that's just some old fluky parable? I mean, hey, they done made a glow in the dark sheep now. I mean, what, hey, there's modern technology that's sweeping the nation that it's so difficult for you to even see. It's difficult for you to know. I mean, hey, where are we at, really? Are we aliens? You know, or do we come here and get transferred? I mean, we can go all isn't scared. We can pull that out and let everybody want to debate it out. But in the end, if you believe in that, then that's your belief system. You know, that's your belief system. You know, it all depends on how far you are if you get enlightened, how far is your enlightenment is, how far if you believe, you know, or why you believe. Because that should be the question. Why do people believe? Why do you believe when there's so much opportunity out there for you not to believe? Each and every day, there's so much opportunity for you not to believe in it. Being disbelief is a damn shame. So why do you believe? Why do you believe? You know. So that's the whole thing. I mean, where's your faith? Where's your God? But I don't want to preach. Because, you know me, I don't proclaim or profess to be that perfect man. We all fall short of that perfection because of Adam. But I believe. And sometimes I walk around, people don't believe, friends, families, people on the street, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, they can be what they want to be, but I believe. I try to have my children believe. because this is just me, everybody. I'm going to let y'all go out on this note right here. Because if my children, this is me, everybody. This is Jimmy Lee. If my children believe in the Creator, the Most High God, then their children will believe in the Creator and the Most High God. And if they fear God like their father fear God, then I'm satisfied. Teach your children fear, not teach my kids respect like I want my children to respect me. You know, I know my kids are scared of me, but my kids love me. But I mean, they're afraid of me because they're scared to do wrong in my eyes and displease. See, you live in that fear as, oh, you're scared. No. Fear is not wanting to be seen wrong in the eyes of the Creator. People just need to go on. You know what I'm saying? People just need to know how to find out and flow it out. You know, so this is how I do it. This is Jimmy Lee. And we're going to be on tomorrow, everybody. And y'all just got to tune in and check me out and see how we do it. You know. Because I'm about to get the Holy Ghost up in here. Good night. May your God be with you, everybody.
Make a difference. Jackie D.